Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Built down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. This is going to be almost everything non-COVID. We have been on a COVID train. We're talking everything COVID. And there's one thing that I have determined in my huge embarkment on trying to read every possible thing that I could about COVID. And there's one thing that I know for almost absolute certainty, and that is, of course, that we know almost absolutely nothing. We don't know what an antibody test means. We don't actually know how accurate the tests are. The numbers for the modeling are way off because we don't have good tests. And in order to have good tests, you have to have good modeling. You have to have good tests. So we don't know anything. We know that it can live on surfaces, but we don't know if that's transmissible when it is on the surface. We know that it can be transmitted, but we don't know if you get it once, if you can transmit it continuously, or if it kind of waxes and wanes. If you can get it again, we have no idea. What I know to be absolutely certain is that, well, we don't know. So I'm going to take a break from the COVID research, the COVID pandemic of articles, if you will, and I'm going to touch on everything that is not COVID. But don't worry, I will continue to talk about COVID when any big article comes out. But until that time, let's go on a COVID pandemic break. And with that being said, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. Andrew Built, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing. There is something all so convenient or all amazing, all knowing, all powerful about a study that just answers a simple question. And that is clearly seen in this paper titled Association Between Renin-Angiotensin System Blockade Discontinuation and All-Cause Mortality Among Persons with Low Estimated GFR. Here is an important question for all of you out there listening, and that is, when a person has a poor renal function, what should you do about their ACE inhibitor or their ARB? When should you stop it? This cohort study compared clinical outcomes of just over 1,200 patients who had their ACE inhibitor or ARB discontinued with a propensity score match sample of over 2,500 patients who did not have their ACE inhibitor or ARB discontinued. And then the study looked to see whether stopping the renin-angiotensin system blockade, whether that be the ACE inhibitor or the ARB, in people with poor renal function made any difference at all to all-cause mortality, major adverse cardiovascular events, and end-stage kidney disease over the next 5 years. Well, I'll give you the easy answer, and the easy answer is, did it make a difference? No. No, it did not. In fact, in a follow-up, those individuals who had their ACE inhibitor or ARB discontinued were associated with an increased risk of both mortality and major adverse cardiovascular events. Now, remember, it was mortality, major adverse cardiovascular events, and kidney disease, progression of their kidney disease. Well, what about the kidneys, you ask? The kidney disease did not progress. This is the best we have so far, but have no fear. The STOP ACE trial, a 3-year multi-center open label randomized clinical trial, just concluded recruitment of just over 400 participants in June of 2018, and the results should be out sometime in 2021, hopefully. But in absence of this randomized control trial that has not been published yet, I think that this is the best evidence we have, and we should continue the ACE inhibitor and the ARB when the patient has chronic renal failure. Of course, this needs to be discussed with your favorite nephrologist. However, I am all in favor of continuing the medication at this time, provided that your nephrologist is also on board. Now, many people will say that I am overly hard on certain drug companies, or that I am overly particularly picky about big pharma and the way that they run their trials. And I would say I'm probably not picky enough. However, I do appreciate big pharma because they are the only ones with the deep pockets that can run some of the clinical trials that are really needed. However, let's be honest, they all have their own agenda and their own outcomes that they want to see happen. They don't ever run the trial hoping to find a negative trial. They only run the trial in hopes that it'll be a positive trial, and they skew the inclusion criteria and the exclusion criteria to best fit their practice in the hopes that their drug will make it onto your commonly prescribed drugs. Because as I've said before, the most commonly prescribed drug for you is the drug that you most recently just prescribed. If whatever that blood pressure medication is, that's the most likely blood pressure medication you're going to prescribe. Whatever cholesterol medication is, that's the most likely cholesterol medication you're going to prescribe. The list goes on and on. It can go from antibiotics all the way up to immune modulators. It doesn't really matter. But whatever you previously prescribed is likely what you're going to continue to prescribe. But I digress, because we know that Big Pharma has a lot of money. But how do they spend that money is no more clearly seen than in this article titled Lobby Expenditures and Campaign Contributions by Pharmaceutical and Health Product Industry in the United States, 1990 to 2018. Big Pharma has a lot of money, as I already said, and sometimes they use it for good, like clinical trials that we otherwise would never get. However, in this article, they looked between 1999 and 2018 and found out that the industry spent, on average, $233 million per year on lobbying the U.S. federal government and $414 million on contributions to presidential and congressional electoral candidates, national party committees, and outside spending groups. That, my friends, is a lot of millions of dollars. My fear is that everyone has their price. Everyone has the price at which they are willing to maybe give away their vote or tweak their morals ever so slightly in order to make sure that they can fund their second beach house or the pool in the backyard. And I am afraid with that much money being given to the individuals who make the laws that maybe some of Big Pharma's big bills will be skewed in their favor in order to preserve the couple million that the candidates will keep in their pocket. And as this article clearly states, of the 20 senators and 20 House representatives who received the most contributions from Big Pharma and the health industries, 39 of the 40 belonged on committees with jurisdiction over health-related legislative matters, and 24 of them were in senior positions. I mean, come on, that just smells a little fishy. And in years where there were key referendums or key reforms on the ballot to be voted on, well, you can bet your bottom dollar that the industry also used their bottom dollar to persuade the votes. In fact, almost $400 million during this time frame were given to state candidates and committees who were recipients in California. Why is California so important, you said? Well, because they had on the docket a major drug cost containment measure, Proposition 79. What is Proposition 79, you ask? Proposition 79 would mandate an agreement between the California Department of Health Services and drug companies, which would keep drug prices lower for lower and middle income prescription drug consumers. As you can imagine, when the drug companies gave the candidates and the state representatives almost $400 million, this bill was defeated because that would not be in the best interest of the drug company. Or maybe the drug was just defeated because, let's be honest, who really actually wants lower drug cost for the middle and lower income consumer? I'm not saying this was a perfect bill because I didn't actually read the whole thing or take the time to learn the ups and downs of the bill entirely in and of itself. But I can say that when state candidates and committees in California get almost $400 million from Big Pharma, there is a slim shot the bill is going to pass. Everyone has their price, and sadly, Big Pharma has the money to make sure that they can almost always name that price. This is a depressing article, and I only bring it up for you, the listener, so you can realize that Big Pharma, although they seem like they may or may not have good intentions, they have wildly deep pockets, and we should always be critical because they are always out there trying to persuade, skew, twist, turn the data in their favor. And as long as you understand that, it helps you be more skeptical of the information that is being published. Now, remember at the beginning of this podcast when I said I love a study that answers a simple question? It just sticks right to the point, a simple clinical question that I can take with me the next day in practice. Well, that is no more clearly seen than in this paper in Annals of Rheumatology Disease titled Comparing Naproxen and Low-Dose Colchicine for Treatment of Gout Flares in Primary Care. This is awesome. You have a gout flare. The question is, low-dose colchicine or naproxen, which one is better? 6 one way, half a dozen the other. If you ask about 12 rheumatologists, well, in this study, they took almost 400 patients with acute gout flares and a GFR greater than 30. That's key, GFR greater than 30, and randomized them to either naproxen, 750 milligrams, initial dose, followed by 250 milligrams, three times a day for 1 week, or colchicine, 0.5 milligrams three times a day for 4 days. In the end, pain relief was similar in both naproxen and the colchicine group at 7 days and at 1 month. But as can be expected, diarrhea was more common in the colchicine group, but constipation was more common in the naproxen group. It truly is 6 one way, half a dozen the other. And in the end, No difference in the pain scale at 7 days and 1 month, which is the important question answered and can be taken to bedside tomorrow. Now, speaking of bedside, hopefully some of you were able to deliver breakfast in bed to your mother this past Sunday, and maybe you weren't able to deliver breakfast in bed this year, but in years past, whatever it may be. And I can tell you one thing about my mother. I have always heard from her, I had to walk uphill both ways. I had to walk to school uphill both ways. I had to walk to practice uphill both ways. And there is ultimately something to be said about having to walk to school uphill both ways. Of course, the first thing that can be said is it was certainly a safer way to travel. There's not nearly as many car accidents when you're walking uphill both ways. It can also be said that it's a pretty inefficient and slow way to travel. I mean, ideally, you'd walk uphill one way and then downhill the other way, so that way you'd gain the momentum of gravity. But I digress. There has to be faster ways this day and age to travel. And that is clearly seen in this article titled Electric Scooter Injuries and Hospital Admissions in the United States, 2014 to 2018. In this study, the authors looked at a large database of emergency department visits for injury and found a threefold increase in power scooter injuries between 2014 and 2018. Almost a third of the injuries were to the head or lower extremity. You might be thinking to yourself, kids these days will never learn. Kids these days just don't have the balance to maintain on a high-flying scooter. However, the evidence shows that the largest increase in injuries came in those individuals aged 18 to 34 years old, not in those individuals less than the age of 18. In fact, those individuals that were 18 to 34 accounted for more injuries than any other age group. So maybe, just maybe, our parents had it right and we should go back to walking uphill both ways. At least we would prevent emergency room visits from electric scooters. Now, the next article is one of my favorite articles that I've recently read, only because it drastically changes my practice, and it's something I've never questioned in medicine before. Title of this podcast is Questioning Medicine, so I know that seems a little bit ironic, but if I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times, and that is, our tests that we use are not perfect. In fact, they're far from perfect. The interesting thing about the tests that we order is that we all expect them to be 100% accurate, 100% sensitive, and 100% specific, but we know this can never be. And that case is no more clearly seen than in this study or this article titled, What is the Risk of Missing Legionnaires' Disease Relying on Urinary Antigen Testing Solely, a Retrospective Belgian Multicenter Study. You see, in my hospital where I work, when we're testing for Legionnaires' disease, we use the urine antigen. We collect the urine antigen, we send it to the lab, and almost always it is negative. And I had never thought to myself, well, what if these are false negatives? What if this actually isn't real? Well, in this study, they looked at Legionnaires' disease confirmed by PCR, which is basically as close as you can get to the gold standard, and compared that with the urine sensitivity. Urine antigen test was negative for 20 of the 45 cases that were confirmed by PCR. Yes, that's absolutely correct. The urine antigen test missed basically half of the cases, which makes me question, why do we even order the test if it's missing half of the cases? And speaking of tests we shouldn't be ordering, how about this study titled The Association Between Low Density Lipoprotein Cholesterol and Incident of Atherosclerotic Cardiovascular Disease in Older Adults, results from the National Institute of Health pooled cohort, which looked at the degree between LDL cholesterol levels and risk of first cardiovascular event in almost 3,000 healthy adults age older than 75 years old. And in the end, both unadjusted and adjusted analysis, researchers found there was no association, no significant association. One more time, I repeat myself, no significant association between the LDL cholesterol levels and 5-year incidence of adverse cardiovascular events. Luckily for all of us, currently underway is the STAR trial, which has about 18,000 75-year-old adults randomized to statin or placebo, which is the randomized controlled trial we are all waiting for. But sadly, there will be no results until at least 2021 or 2022, but stay tuned and I can promise you I will talk about it here. And speaking of things I have talked about here on Questioning Medicine before, you may have recalled earlier this year, I said that one of the top articles in 2019 was the article that talked about dapagliflozin being effective in both those individuals with and without diabetes who had heart failure. AKA, if you have heart failure, it doesn't necessarily matter if you have diabetes. This dapagliflozin drug is a people drug, not necessarily a diabetes drug. It's a heart failure drug, not necessarily a heart failure with diabetes drug. And that is what I said then, and that is what I say now. And luckily now, mark it on your calendars, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, May 6th, FDA has approved the SGLT2 inhibitor, dapagliflozin, to help lower the risk for cardiovascular death and heart failure hospitalization in patients with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction. This indication is for adults regardless of whether they have type 2 diabetes. So not only was I saying it then, not only am I saying it now, but finally, here we go, on May 6th, the FDA also agrees with me. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, let's wrap this thing up. Let's close this out. Let's put a nice little bow on it, and let's go over every article we've talked about so far in hopefully 30 seconds or less. If your patient has renal failure and it's getting worse, you should probably get the nephrologist on board and don't stop the ACE inhibitor or ARB. It seems to have an increase on their mortality, an increase on badness, but no worsening of their kidney disease progression. And Big Pharma, they have a lot of money. They spend a lot of money and they give a lot of money to individuals who write the laws. How much money, you ask? Well, around $233 million a year. And if you have a bill on the docket that says, oh, we are going to somehow control or regulate Big Pharma, well, then they're willing to drop up to $400 million to make sure that these bills are not passed. It's a sad day, it's a true day, and it's just something we all have to be aware of. Now, what about the individual that comes in with a gout flare? Primary care office, what do you do? What do you do? Naproxen or colchicine? The difference is, if you're looking for pain at 7 days and 1 month, there is no difference. Give one, give the other, just depends. It's all on you. Now, there is something to be said about electric scooters. They are much faster than walking uphill both ways. However, they also cause way more injuries, and those injuries are more likely seen in 18 to 34 year olds than those individuals less than age 18. There's got to be a better way. Maybe, just maybe, we should go back to walking uphill. But I'm clumsy and probably would fall over my feet and still end up in the emergency room. And if you're looking for Legionnaire's disease, well, you can't necessarily count on the urine antigen. In fact, the urine antigen test was negative 20 of the 45 cases in which PCR actually confirmed the disease. So, what do you do? Well, if your hospital requires you to order it, go for it. If you have a high index of suspicion, you should probably still treat anyways, and just realize that this test, like every test, is not perfect. In fact, it's far from perfect, and we have to keep this in our cognitive framework as we're looking at the patient sitting in front of us. And speaking of the patient sitting in front of you, if you have a 75-year-old relatively healthy, well, then don't worry about checking an LDL level, because the LDL cholesterol has no, and I mean no, significant association between LDL cholesterol levels and the 5-year incidence of adverse cardiovascular events. You can't say your LDL level is 100, so you're going to definitely have a cardiovascular event, or only 20% of the time have a cardiovascular event. No, the LDL level is an independent variable of it. It's all by itself out on Survivor Island, or at least now, because that's the best available evidence we have. Wait till 2021 or 2022 when the STAR trial comes out, and then we will have more information, and I will be here first on Questioning Medicine talking to you about it. And last, but certainly not least, dapagliflozin. I've been saying it for months now. This is a heart failure drug. It's not a heart failure drug for those with diabetes. It's not a heart failure drug for those without diabetes. It's just a heart failure drug, and we should approve it as such. The evidence states it clearly. And now, officially, as of May 6th, the FDA is on board. They completely agree. They say, yep, you're right. We should do it. So, dapagliflozin, there you go. That's the new heart failure drug. That will be on your boards in about 10 or 15 years when the boards finally catch up with the rest of medicine. There you go, dapagliflozin and heart failure. So until next time, I'm going to end this podcast. I'm going to wrap this one up, and I'm going to end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.